Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and for a record second time running is hangover free. I'm Kevin Day and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Two shows in a row, Kieran, without a hangover. And this is a morning recording. We're recording this in the morning. This is the level of professionalism I'm bringing to this job for our lovely listeners.
The bastard is that much closer, Kevin. That much closer.
It is, Kieran, but there are a couple of moments in some of these questions when I suspect the BAFTA will be drifting away again. Because there's a couple of there's a couple of moments where I can't see a way around double entendres, to be perfectly honest, but there you are. It's questions day, and we have, as always, some very interesting questions, Kieran. And the first of them comes from Jacob Tidy. Jacob, hello, Jacob, says, I'm a Palace fan. Brackets irrelevant to the question before I would throw it in. Always throw that bit of information in, Jacob. In general, I'd like to know what football team you all support.
Yes, except for, that's a really good idea, actually.
One that shall not be named. Jacob is also a long-time lover of the pod, so he's a Palace fan and a long-time lover of the pod, which is doubly important. Alongside my day job, says Jacob, I am studying a master's in sports law, and I'm doing some research on intermediaries, and I came across the interesting case of Jorge Mendes and Wolves. It's reported that Fosun own a 15% stake in the holding company of Mendes Agency. Gestifute, is it, Kieran?
That's right. Yes, very good.
I've very confidently went into Jorge and didn't do any research into Gestifute. Along with Fosun paying Gestifute as an advisor, I was wondering if you'd be able to work out how much each party would be making on a transfer where, let's say, Mendes acted for Wolves, the player being sold by Wolves, and also the buying club, as I believe may have happened with the Doherty transfer to Tottenham. Now, this is an area we've explored before, Kieran, but not really the financial aspect of an agent working for all three parties and how the money is divvied up.
Yeah, I think this one takes the somewhat Byzantine relationships between agents and clubs even further, in the sense that the club owner owns a stake in the agency, which you get into so many circularities here is to be astounding. But I took a look at when Wolves signed Fabio Silva, which I don't think has necessarily been one of their greatest signings, I think it was for 40 million. And apparently Gestifute picked up 7 million on that. So yeah, that was well over 15% at the time. And it is indicative of how beneficial transfers can be to an agency. And I think there's the classic case of Paul Pogba going from Juve to Manchester United, where he picked up over 21 million at the time. And that was just from Juventus. So we don't know how much Raiola picked up from the player and the buying club. So I think this particular relationship has been queried, I think is the politest way I can use to describe it, in the sense that how can you be independent when the club owner is going to benefit from a transfer, as well as the agent, presumably as well as the player, and you're trying to work out what is an appropriate price. So, yeah, I think Jacob is absolutely right to highlight this. But yeah, football being the way that it is, it would just get nodded through.
Does Mendes also represent Nuno?
I don't know. I suspect so, given that he does have a very close relationship with a lot of Portuguese players and managers. So, we will investigate further.
Well, no, the only reason I ask is that football fans being football fans, when Nuno was linked with the Palace job, very closely linked with the Palace job, and as soon as it fell through, just about every single Palace fan just went, that'll be the agent then. It's just this assumption. It's still, no matter how much we try and highlight the fact that most agents are decent people doing a good job for their players, there's still this perception in football that a lot of problems are caused by the agent. And I found it very interesting that immediately Palace fans just went, oh, that'll be a problem with the agent.
Yeah, well, Google is our friend, and I can confirm that relationship is, you are correct. So Nuno is Mendes's client. I believe also he was his very first client. So they go back a long way together, go back to the mid-90s.
See, this is how our bizarre relationship as a double act has developed, Kieran, that we're on this same wavelength, that I talk just long enough for you to be able to Google something. And new listeners are thinking, Kieran goes very quiet every now and again, while Kevin witters on about something that's only vaguely related to the subject. And it's because Kieran's Googling, everybody. Kieran has to be doing something. He can't just be talking to me. He has to be doing several. Kieran's a multitasker. Next question comes from Alex Weir. And Alex says, I have a question about team kits. When players turn out in the Premier League and the EFL, their kits look immaculate. Are the players wearing brand new kit for each game, sometimes twice a game, possibly? If so, what's happening to all the used kit? I assume the top teams get their kits free from the manufacturers. If that's so, at what point in the football pyramid does that stop and teams need to pay for kit, and how much does that cost them? Now, this is interesting, Kieran, because just last Thursday night, FYP, the Palace podcast that I do, we did a live show, which was a lovely, lovely evening, and I can't thank everybody who was there enough for the love and affection they gave me in the difficult circumstances at the moment. But the special guest was Danny Butterfield, player who scored a hat-trick for us in 4 minutes, perfect hat-trick as well, against Wolves in the FA Cup. But we were talking about the difference between Palace now with our what seems to be a plan, which is unusual, but also a wonderful academy, recruitment system, so on and so forth. And he talked about his first day signing for Palace when he turned up at the training ground, which was in a portal cabin, and there was a little old man nailing down a yard of carpet outside because there was a trip hazard. And Danny said he pointed out that the carpet was now a worse trip hazard than the... But the subject of kids, he mentioned the playoff final when we beat West Ham and Cardiff. And he said the pitch at Sunderland in the semi-final just a few nights before, he reckoned they'd sprayed it green for the TV cameras. He said the Palace players' kit got really grubby, and the kit man couldn't get the stains out, and he didn't have another kit. So he said it was really embarrassing because they were in the tunnel and West Ham had these brand new sparkling white tracksuits, and he was just counting the grass stains on the shirt of the Palace player in front of him, all of us went, surely we had more than one. He said, no, in those days we were so skint, we only had one kit. So I find this is quite an interesting question for me.
Yes, yeah, I think it's an absolute cracker. I've been in contact with some clubs. Manchester United, for example, they get asked, clearly by a lot of charities, but a lot of people, for match-worn shirts, and they give them to, or they auction them on behalf of good causes. So if you take a look at the Cristiano Ronaldo shirt, they recently played Spurs, and they turned them over 3-0. That shirt's presently going for £36,000.
Wow.
And also all of the shirts that they wore against Manchester City, because they had the Poppy emblem, all of those are being auctioned as well. So if the bigger the club, the more likely they're going to be able to have shirts on a fairly close to a match by match basis. As we drop down the divisions, things are not as benevolent from the manufacturers, and you can understand that. So I contacted our very good friend Andy Holt at Accrington Stanley, and in true Andy style, he says, we wash them until they're fucked. Which, I love Andy so much.
Yeah, fair enough. Well,
that's good. Yeah, because I think we're speaking to Dale Vince soon, and he's Mr. Sustainable, and that's really good. Because we should be recycling food, sorry, recycling clothes as much as we can. I also spoke to David Artell, who's the crew manager, who's been on the show as well, and he says They get two home and two away kits for the first team, one home and one away kit for the under-23s, and the same for the under-18s. And after we finish them at the end of the season, the players get to keep one home kit and one away, and the second home and away kit go to the kit sponsors. So, you know, they are getting a fair amount of use over the course of the season. And I think, you know, the kit man do a damn good job to get them coming out looking so pristine on a week-by-week basis, you know, because we all remember what it was like when we were at school and we had, you know, three shirts to last a school year, and by the state they were in after about 2 weeks of us lot wearing them.
Yeah, we've talked about, you talking about three football shirts, Kieran, or three?
No, three school shirts.
Oh, three school shirts. Okay, all right, fine. It is possible, by the way, to recycle food. Remember that really bad hangover I had show before last? I recycled quite a lot of food after that. That Andy Holt does make me laugh a lot. I think, yeah, it's like the old days. You wash the kit, and not only should you wash it, I think the players should take it in turns to take the kit home so their mum can wash the kit. So do it properly. Keep in touch with, or their dad, because it's 2021 before anyone says iPod. And also on the subject of Premier League clubs and shirts, and people at home will know, you know who you are. Some of you have done this. Middle-aged men, stop forcing your children to hold up a cardboard sign saying, "It's my birthday, can I have your shirt, Declan Rice?" It's getting out of hand. There was a game live on Sky last week, and I counted 13 reluctant children holding up a sign for a shirt that their dad clearly wants. Because it seems always to be a player. They all seem to be picking a larger player. Why do these kids always want the big players? Oh, it's because their dad. There's a couple more. Danny Butterfield was very interesting about football in the old days and told a story about Neil Warnock's pile cream that I don't think I'll ever get out of my head. I don't think anybody who was at that do slept that night. Neil Warnock sounds quite the character. yes. Our next question comes from Mark Last, and I really does slightly annoy. I shouldn't have had to say to Guy, put this question last. Why do you have a question from somebody called Mark Last and not make it the last question? And we know the answer because he just said we would have banged on about it for 10 minutes. But I said, we'll bang on about it wherever it is. Anyway, Mark Last says, "I love the podcast." Thank you, Mark. "It's the only one I found that combines my loves of football and business administration."
That's a strange Venn diagram, isn't it?
It's amazing to think there aren't hundreds of other podcasts out there combining Mark's loves of football and business and administration, isn't it? Mark says, "I'm opposed to gambling sponsorship in football," which is certainly a very hot topic at the moment. "But notice that in FIFA 2020, and presumably other versions too, that the front of shirt sponsorships of 32 red are replicated in the game. Do the sponsors pay extra for this exposure? And does it break any under 18 advertising rules?" Which I think is the most interesting part of the interesting question. PS, I've tried my hardest with the grammar and structure of this, Kevin. This question, this Kevin has ruined it. I've tried my hardest with the grammar and structure of this question, so Kevin doesn't have to correct it too much. The irony being there, Mark, that I had to correct myself. So, I do like grammar. Mrs. Day is the grammar. She's a Nazi when it comes to grammar. Spelling's my big thing. I like proper spelling. But it's a very well-structured question, Mark. Well done. But I'm never going to be cross with anybody. Just bung down the question you want to bung down. Don't worry about how you structure it. But an interesting question, because I'm amazed to learn that front-of-shirt sponsorships for betting companies are on FIFA 2020, considering, as Mark says, so many people under the age of 16, 14, 12 will be playing it.
Yes, I mean, it is a way, it's a very good way of stealth marketing for gambling companies, although surely we could say the same with regards to matches which are being broadcast live and even pre-recorded, that fans get to see them, but they don't immerse in them to the same extent. This is a organizations like FIFA, they want authenticity. So it's actually a free bonus for the sponsorship companies, and they can use this to their advantage. A couple of years ago, Stevenage were sponsored by Burger King, and everybody went at the time, But yeah, Burger King, they're pretty big, and Stevenage, no disrespect, they're not the biggest club in the world. And this was an absolutely superb spot by Burger King. They know that FIFA is really popular, and they said, well, we think that by sponsoring a small club who has a colour scheme which is similar to the Burger King colours, we can get a bit of stealth marketing. And they ended up with Burger King being, with Stevenage being the biggest club on FIFA in terms of matches played in something called career mode. Now, I don't understand what career mode is. And it went viral. And also, Stevenage ended up selling out of their kits because there were so many FIFA fans all over the world who sort of bought into this, and people were uploading photographs of them eating their, was it a Whopper? I'm not an expert on these things. Playing FIFA with the Stevenage shirt on, that Stevenage actually ran out of shirts. So you know, sometimes these things can be utilized. It was very successful, and I think this season Stevenage are being sponsored by Amazon Prime, which are going again. You know, the size of those organized, you know, because they've realised that this is actually a way of getting a local club into the eyes of millions of people around the world. So it's a really smart relationship from the marketing departments. But as far as the gambling is concerned, it doesn't break any rules because the, you know, TV, if you think about, you know, when we watch matches at you know, all hours of the day on a Saturday and a Sunday, there is no threshold at 9 o'clock to have with some you know, in terms of, you know, language and nudity and other things which are deemed to be something to be shielded from younger eyes. So it's very useful from the sponsor's perspective, and effectively it's a free hit for them as well, because the FIFA players want to see the authentic kits. It helps FIFA, it helps Electronic Arts in terms of the marketing of their game. I think the clubs benefit overall because they now know that you're going to be not just getting 38 games in the Premier League a season, you're going to be getting millions and millions of people looking at your logo, looking at your brand from playing these games as well.
It does seem slightly odd, though, Kieran, when we know that if you're selling actual shirts in the club shop to children, you have to have a different sponsor. You can't have a gambling sponsor on those shirts. And yet, you know, very young children will be playing these games with gambling sponsors on the shirts. And I also don't know what career mode is. And Ali would say that counts in life generally. Secondly, I try so that people at home don't realise how hard I try to rid this show of any chance of double entendre, and then you're straight in with Whopper. It just didn't occur to me that this question would go. I didn't think for 1 minute that this via Stevenage and Burger King we'd get to Whopper. And also, for those of you who are interested, and I know that's most of you, in the relationship between football, television and gambling, there's a really, really interesting piece in the latest Private Eye about the labyrinthine relationship between Sky and Sky Bet and other gambling sponsors, which is well worth a read for most of you, because I know you're listening to this because that's the sort of thing you're interested in. Now, our next question comes from Ray Barry, and it's a short question, Kieran, but it's one that I think you'll find like a warm hug. This will be like a cup of soup, this question for you, Kieran. Ray says, I'd like to look myself at club earnings, but how do you find them on the company's house site? What would you type, or how do you search for reports?
Right, Ray, and anybody else that is interested in this, what you do is that you go to the gov.uk website, and then you click on where it says get information about a company, and then you've got to start putting in the company names. Now, the good news is that for the vast majority of football clubs, It's Manchester United Limited, or it's Newcastle United Limited, and you can start to do a bit of ferreting around and work out, and just pick up those figures immediately, or pick up pick up the company name. Some of them are a bit more complicated. As you know, at Palace, it's CPFC 2010 Limited. We've got West Ham, who are WH Holding. We've got Derby County, who are Sevco 5112. It's not as if Mel Morris is perhaps trying to hide things by. I'd never accuse him of that. If you a quick way of finding out the club names is that if you go to the Football Association Premier League Limited and the Football League Limited brackets the, which is the EFL and the Premier League respectively, they have something which is called a confirmation statement. And a confirmation statement lists all of the shareholders in both the Premier League and the EFL. And therefore, it actually gives, because the Premier League has got 21 shareholders, which is every single Premier League football club, plus the Football Association, and it's very similar for the EFL, you can actually find out the names of the individual shareholders, either the names of the individual clubs which are held at Companies House, and that's a good shortcut. And I did find an error about 5 years ago in the EFL list, and I got very, very excited, as you can imagine, because one of the shareholders, which was a company which had gone into liquidation. Can you imagine how nerd heaven I was in at the time?
Oh, the Baroness must have had 2 days of hell.
Yes.
How do we rate, just off the back of that, genuinely interesting question, because you know what? It never occurred to me, being an innocent soul, certainly when it comes to finances, that companies would have strange names in order to try and obfuscate what's actually going on. But how do we rate compared to other countries in terms of transparency? Is this a worldwide thing, a global thing that, in every country you can just type in a few words in Google and find out this information?
No, I've got to say that the UK system is one of the best in the world. In the USA, for example, private companies are that. They are private and you get next to no information out of them. I've always argued that football is a special industry in this country, and I think that was endorsed by the interim report of the fan-led review, and I think the final report is due out this week. And therefore, clubs should put out more information than the minimum legal restrictions, for especially for those clubs in League One and League Two. And hopefully that might be one of the things that they recommend, although equally I'm not overconfident. But yes, the UK is pretty fantastic. And they used to charge you £1 per document at Companies House. And I can't remember which chancellor it was. I think it was Gordon Brown or Big G, as I refer to him when he phones me up.
Of course.
I think he actually changed that, so it's all now free, and it's a treasure trove of financial information. Now, I'm the first to admit that financial information is niche and it only attracts a relatively small audience, but it does allow you to do a lot of investigative work and analytical work if that's what you want to do, and it's it's completely transformed my ability to look into the finances of clubs, provided, of course, that they actually bother to comply with company law. And certain clubs, I'm naming no club apart from Derby County and Mel Morris. Here I must separate. Derby County fans are not responsible for Mel Morris's financial mismanagement of the club.
Of course.
It does allow you to at least have some form of summary, and you do find the occasional nuggets in terms of what's happening in the boardroom and so on.
You remember last week, Kieran, I told you how unfunny, shall we put it, Ali finds me saying there's 1,000 things I want to say to you whenever the radio news person says in the city.
Yes.
Imagine how more unfunny she finds it when every time the name Gordon Brown is mentioned, I go, text you like son. That just stopped being funny for Ali long, long ago. She was so pleased when he retired from frontline politics because every time his name was mentioned, Gordon Brown, you can't not do it. I like this. Tim Holden's got a question about something we've probably mentioned 150 times on the pod, and they've never actually questioned why we mention this particular phrase. Tim Holden says, I really enjoy listening to the pod, but why does Kieran reference clubs being sold for a pound? Why a pound? Why not give it away for nothing, as that's what they're effectively doing? Is there a legal reason why a nominal fee has to be exchanged? And furthermore, have any clubs actually been sold for a pound?
Right. Well, thanks for the question, Tim. If we look at both elements here, the reason why a nominal fee has to be exchanged is that if you are selling a football club, then that will be via a contract. And with a contract, you have to have something called consideration, and consideration is payment. So, you know, whether it's £1 or £100 million, provided, and you may have heard of peppercorn rents, for example, where so and that was you do have to pay something, but and it's got to be more than zero. So a £1 is effectively the easiest thing for a firm of for a legal firm to put into a contract, and therefore I have given you consideration, I have given you a fee, and in return you have given me Chelsea Football Club, as happened with Ken Bates when he acquired the club famously, and he then sold it for considerably more than £1 to Roman Abramovich. And we have seen an awful lot of clubs be sold for £1. Portsmouth, Swansea, Hull, I think Bury to Steve Dale. I know Brighton was sold for £56.25. Wow. Which is slightly more than that, but not much more. It's a common feature. But when people say, well why? Because clearly, if you think about Chelsea, prime real estate in the centre of London, when you acquire a football club for £1, you acquire everything in relation to it, and that's both its assets and its debts. So if the debts exceed the assets, under those circumstances, that you say, right, I'll pay a pound, and it's up to me now to sort everything out.
Under normal circumstances, or if this was a different pod, I'd be asking you why Brighton was sold for such an unusual sum, but we've got a lot of questions to go, and, you know, Brighton. Chris Saunders says, if you use the cost of Premier League TV deals as a measure of inflation, which Premier League squad had the highest net book value?
It's actually very difficult, Chris, to work this out, because what you have to do is you have to know the value of individual transfer deals, and we don't know that these days. You know, there are many which are undisclosed, and we've discussed that before. And then you've got to be able to tie that into the individual TV deals, which is something which I have done on a global basis. So if we take a look at squad costs in total, the Manchester City have the highest. In the most recent accounts, they were £978 million. They have subsequently, of course, signed Jack Grealish, so therefore they will be the first club in English football to have a £1 billion squad.
Wow.
So that's looking at it from the perspective of what we have today. If we're looking at the total spending of all clubs, and I have adjusted these for inflation, the biggest spenders are Chelsea, because the fees that were paid by Roman Abramovich when he first acquired the club in 2003, he spent an absolute fortune in those early years. And once you do factor in the acceleration in the value of TV deals since then, it's Chelsea first. I think it's Manchester United second, and then Manchester City third.
Okay. Question from Robert McPherson, who I'm guessing hails from north of the border. Well, north of the border from where we're sitting. Robert says, as we all know, winter in England is terrible.
I'm not so sure about that.
I disagree. For a state, it can't be terrible enough. I love winter. Winter's lovely, except I don't think we're ever going to get a bloody winter again. If it doesn't start getting cold soon, I'm going to get very cross. If I believed in people having SAD, I'd think I've got reverse SAD. But yeah. Anyway, as we all know, winter in England is terrible. We've debated that. Believe it or not, it's even worse in Scotland. I'm prepared to accept that it can get colder in Scotland than it is in a vineyard in Sussex, Kieran. If Scottish football moved to playing a summer season, would we be able to raise more money from TV rights because there's nothing else to watch? And if we manage to qualify again for a summer tournament, surely we can just have a summer break for the duration. Now, I mean, for most football fans, instinctively, you go, no, not football in the summer. It doesn't work. But I think it's quite a sensible suggestion from Robert. If you had the majority of the season across, you know, from April through to September, you're going to attract a lot more people, I would guess, certainly to live games.
I think there could be a case from a television perspective. And I know he has identified the fact that there's summer tournaments. But remember, we now have the Euros every 2 years, every 4 years. We've got the World Cup every 4 years, potentially every 2 years. There's not a lot of wiggle room. You've got the Olympics as well, which attracts some of the younger players. So there's already a lot of demand. I think actually the issue there are some leagues which I think some of the Scandinavian leagues play across the summer. So it's not impossible. I think the challenges would be, to a certain extent, is that if you were Rangers or Celtic, you're also, of course, playing in the Europa League, and hoping to play in the Champions League. So that means that the players are playing football 12 months a year.
Yeah,
fair. Which gives problems. Another issue is that player contracts, in the main, expire on the 30th of June. Now, that fits in well with our traditional season. So if Scottish football moved to a summer sport, and let's say that contracts expired on, you know, the 31st of October or the 31st of December, that's going to cause, again, it'll be messy for those clubs which are playing in Europe, because how do you tie things in? And I think it's messy for the players, because if they are moving from another European country to Scotland, and what are you going to do for the 6 months of a contract which could be going fallow? But it's not impossible, there are issues with regards to the value of Scottish TV rights. You know, the SPFL will say, well, you know, we've negotiated with Sky, and we believe that we've got as big a deal as possible. At present, we have a number of clubs, such as Aberdeen Hearts and so on, who have commissioned a report by Deloitte to see whether the value of Scottish football is understated. And I think TV rights is an area that they will be looking at. So, perhaps this is a question we should perhaps ask of Neil Doncaster. We'll get him back on the show, because he's always keen to pop in for a chat. And perhaps we'll ask him.
He is always keen to pop in for a chat, isn't he? Robert, it sounds like the short answer to your question is no. But I think it's a very good idea, except I don't like football in summer, so I suppose I don't. Dave Brandon says, I have what I fear is a daft laddie question about release clauses. Now, Dave, I don't know how often you listen to this pod. There is nothing anybody can ask on this pod that is as daft as some of the things I've asked. Trust me, nobody out there need fear the fact that their question is too simple or too odd, because it doesn't stop me marching bravely on and asking questions that, if you think my eyebrows go up, you see Kieran's eyebrows when I ask something very simple about amortization, which I do every time I see him because I forget. and the Daft Laddie question is about release clauses. How do other clubs know what the transfer is? Do agents tip off interested clubs? And if a buying club doesn't know the relevant fee and has a bid in excess of the release fee accepted, then what happens? Could they take legal action against the selling club? I mean, this is, you know, the Palace triggered what was reported to be an £8 million release fee for Elise. But that's a very good question. How did Palace know what that release clause was? Would they have gone to Reading and said, has he got a release clause? How much is it? Or does it work the other way around? Reading's just revealed to the world that he's got an £8 million release clause.
No, the release clause officially is a private matter between the football club and the football player.
Okay.
The way that it works in practice is as follows. Because remember Arsenal famously bid 40 million quid and £1 for Luis Suarez, who had a release clause of 40 million pounds.
Yes.
The way that it works is as follows. A club identifies a player it wants to sign. It will actually approach the player via his agent before it approaches the club. Now, it will say that it's going to go through the correct means, but if anybody's ever read the Secret Football Agent, which is a cracking book, this guy says this is the how it's supposed to work and how it does work is as follows. Because the player might not be interested, so what's the point in coming? Unless it's on transfer, in the transfer window when you've got 48 hours of the window left, that's when they tend to actually contact the club first. But if we're talking, some of the big transfers, all of the groundwork takes place in advance. Is the player interested? What's he looking for? And then they will say, if that's what he's expecting in wages, then we know how much we can afford to bid for a transfer. So it shouldn't happen because it's a private contract between employer and employee, but the agent will have been a party to that contract. So in practice, there will be communication. Remember when Liverpool signed Virgil van Dijk from Southampton, and Southampton reported Liverpool for an inappropriate approach to the player, and Liverpool then backed down for 6 months, and he subsequently signed for 6 months. So legal action can be taken place, or the predator club could be reported to the Football Association, because you are supposed to contact the club rather than the player. But that's not always the case in practice.
There you go, Dave. Turned out to be a really interesting question after all.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Now, Spencer Pritchard is a Shrewsbury fan in League One. Spencer Pritchard is a Shrewsbury fan in League One. Take your pick. With all the talk of finances in the EFL being stretched, I wondered if we could get any idea to what extent player wages in the EFL are set to contract in the future. More specifically, what percentage do you expect player wages in the EFL to decrease in the coming months, if at all?
Right, Spencer, this is a classic case of the haves and the have-nots. I've seen some managers, I think the Portsmouth manager, for example, was talking about the ability of some clubs in League One to offer wages which the rest of the division couldn't cope with. So I think fingers have been pointed at a few clubs. Equally, I saw comments from Joey Barton, who actually claimed that he ended up paying the wages at Fleetwood himself for a while, that players were going to have to accept significant reductions, and their highest paid player could potentially be on half of what they were when the contracts were up for renewal. So it really is down to not only the finances of the club, but the wealth of the club owner and how much money they're prepared to put in. Because under the I think it's called salary cap management protocol, or some proper, you know, blue sky thinking away day wage cap that they have in Leagues 1 and 2. In League 1, you're not allowed to spend more than 60% of your revenue on wages. And in League 2, it's 50%. But if the owner of the club puts in a pound, then you can add another pound to the wage bill. So if we have wealthy owners, then we are going to have some clubs who will be able to blitz the rest of the division. You know, it's not sustainable. It's not sort of, you know, it ties in with what I think the majority of clubs would want, but it's causing a bit of bad feeling. But certainly the anecdotal comments that I've had from people in the two lower divisions is that they are expecting a decrease to come through, to manifest itself. The majority of the clubs in the lower two divisions are on sort of a wage to revenue level, which is far, far lower than the Championship. And I think that will accelerate. And what we're also seeing in the Championship itself is, apart from those clubs who have owners, you know, Fulham, for example, they are alleged to be paying Mitrovic over £5 million a year with his new contract, which will be a record for a League One club.
Yeah.
But they've got you know, their owner Shahid Khan is you know, amazingly wealthy, and he can afford to do that. I think for the lower league clubs, it's coming down. In the Championship, it will depend upon the ownership model.
Right. Our next question, which is our third from last question, so it's the one before penultimate. I don't know if there's a fancy phrase for the one before penultimate.
Is it pre-penultimate?
Is it pre-penultimate? Oh, okay. I always get, well, when you use the word pre about anything, Kieran, I get really, really, really genuinely anxious. Question, it comes from Larkin Hogle, who's a friend of the show. Larkin says, your discussion of Liverpool women's team in a recent pod made me wonder, would it be possible for an investor in the women's game to get involved only with Liverpool women? So how is the women's team different from the men's on FSG's investment portfolio?
Right. Certainly it is possible for investors and other people to get involved, because from a legal perspective, they are separate companies. Therefore, they have their own identity. We are now seeing some sponsors of the women's team be different to that of the men's team. So an example would be Everton, who are sponsored by a company called Megathon, which is owned by Alisha Usmanov, who is not anything to do with Everton Football Club officially. That has to be stressed. He is the former business associate of the Everton owner, Farhad Moshiri. And he's also the guy who completely independently paid £35 million for the option to have the naming rights for the stadium and so on. So he's one of his companies is sponsoring the women's team. If you take a look at the finances of the women's team teams in general, they are all losing money. Not huge sums. So as far as FSG are concerned, and FSG are only interested in making money. Yeah. You know, that's where I think that Liverpool's women's team perhaps hasn't been given the TLC that it warrants, because there is an opportunity for growth. We've just seen a report come out from the FA where the aim is for the for attendances in the WSL to average 6,000 by, I think, around about 2024-25, which is a challenging target, but it's not an impossible one. So yes, you can certainly have independent investors and sponsors, and indeed some people have said, would it be better if clubs in the WSL did make more effort to separate themselves from the men's team? I'm not convinced that would work, because you know there's an opportunity for shared resources in terms of medical training facilities and so on.
Our penultimate question then comes from Brian Schmidt. Hello, Brian. And Brian Schmidt says, how have Morecambe's finances been affected with their promotion to League One? Their promotion was incredible to watch, and they achieved promotion with one of, if not the lowest wage budget in the EFL. How are they able to compete financially with teams in League One? And how much will they earn by being in League One versus League Two for at least one season?
Right. Well, he's absolutely right. What Morecambe have achieved is sensational from a financial point of view. Their total wage bill in 2020 was £2.2 million for everybody, you know, the playing staff, the management staff, the backroom staff, and so on. That's £40,000 a week, wow. Which is, you know, you put that into the perspective. We've just been talking about Mitrovic. That will buy you one of his legs. So, which probably isn't going to help very much. It's an amazing achievement. How are they able to compete financially with teams in League One? Well, and you know, we've spoken about Andy at Accrington. Accrington have the lowest budget historically in League One for the last few seasons, and they've managed to do that by being honest with players, you know, saying that we're not a destination club. You know, we can offer you part of the development of your career. They've got a very good relationship at Accrington with John Coleman, the manager, and everybody's pointing in the same direction. And I think that's what Morecambe will be having to do as well. It will be a case of good dressing room, being innovative on and off the pitch, and not trying to compete financially. If somebody comes in and offers more wages, then you just accept that you're going to lose the player.
Now, our last question, Kieran, it comes from Mark Scarf. And technically, this is a legal question, but except it is financial, because if Mark Scarf does what he's asking he should do, he's going to lose a lot of money, basically. So Mark Scarf says, as a person who wants to do a podcast about the Premier League, are there any restrictions on using Premier League in the title? I can understand if I use a brand name or any other signifier to lure people in, and I'm assuming the Premier League is also a trademark brand name. But that said, is it also a generic title for the top tier of English football? So would I get away with having a title such as Premier League News or Premier League Daily as a podcast title? I suspect that he probably wouldn't, Kieran. So call it top 20, Mark. How about that? Because it's an interesting one, because we use the word Premier League all the time. But if you use the word Premier League in a way that Mark's planning to do so, I suspect the Premier League wouldn't be too happy.
Yes, I'm not a lawyer, but I think this might come under what is referred to as passing off, which is, yes, where you put yourself out, and people might take the view that you are representing another institution, and therefore the Premier League, under those circumstances, will want to protect its brand, will also want to protect its reputation. You know, I'm sure Mark would do an absolutely fantastic job with his podcast, but it's not official. Therefore, I would do the same as you. If you think about some of the successful podcasts for clubs in the EFL, they're titles like Not the Top 20 and so on. So yeah, there are
the 72.
And therefore, that's a way of getting the message across without infringing the rights. You know, we couldn't call ourselves Apple Incorporated as a podcast name, because they would rightly say, well, you're not, and you're trying to make money on the back of our name and our our position and our brand and so on. So if you want to take it further, Mark, speak to somebody in the legal profession. If you might have a friend, we have lots of friends in the legal profession who might be able to contact us and confirm what I've just said. Because to be fair, they're normally pretty they're normally pretty much on the case when I get things wrong, and I get things wrong on a regular basis, and I then try to subtly correct them in future episodes.
You sounded a bit like Uncle Terry then, when you said if you want to take things further. And also, it's like, you know, we did point this out to producer guy way back in the day when we first started, that we couldn't call ourselves a Swiss Ramble podcast. That would be very clearly a case of passing off. It's an interesting one, because the advertising industry, it's when you'll occasionally hear an actor that sounds a bit like Stephen Fry, but isn't Stephen Fry. But there's a very fine line that advertising companies sometimes tread when they can't afford Stephen Fry. And they'll find somebody who sounds just enough like him, but not enough like him for Stephen to be taking him to court. Now, thank you to everyone who's made a donation to the pod via our Patreon site. Not that Stephen would do that. He's not that type of person. He's delightful. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, once again, folks, thanks again for all the feedback. We do take heed. If you want to support the club, the podcast in any alternative ways, a vote for us at the FSA Awards would be hugely appreciated in the category of that has no name. but if not, just go along to the that purple icon on Apple, and you can give us 5 stars and write whatever you want. You could say that you would rather the show was presented by Princess Anne and Michael Gove. Makes no difference to us. And I think that'd be quite a surreal experience. I'd certainly listen to that myself.
I'd love to see the look of disapproval on Princess Anne's face as Michael Gove goes into his latest trance dance moves. That'd be very funny. Bye, everybody.
Bye. The Price of Football.
Price of Football.